Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Today we're going to be talking about rumblings in KZN. We're going to be talking a little bit more about political polling. And lastly, we're going to be discussing the NHI. So let's start off by talking about what's going on in KZN. While the National Government of National Unity has taken all the headlines about coalition friction and drama, and the DA does this, the ANC does this, the smaller parties do this. There has been another major coalition government in our country, and that has been the one in KwaZulu-Natal, which is led by the IFP, not the ANC, the IFP-DA, ANC, and the NFP, until recently all being part of that coalition. However, there's been reporting recently that this whole thing seems to be weakening. There's apparently serious infighting over particular appointments within the provincial government of national unity in KZN, with reports coming out in the Sunday Times and City Press that government has serious test of the tensions between parties, and the National Freedom Party has decided that it's no longer on board with the governing coalition. Now, I think the National Freedom Party only has, I think, one seat, but it looks like it might be willing to throw its support behind MK in the province. So at the same time, the IFP says that it has unwavering support and confidence in the National Government of Provincial Unity, and they have rejected any suggestion that there are disagreements about reshuffling or what. They, however, have also said that there's no crisis in the provincial government of unity. So, Herman, what do we make of all this? You know, how is that provincial government doing? It's like quite different from the national one and some of the other coalitions we've seen around the country. Is it in imminent danger of collapse? Is MK about to assume control over KZN?
So I must say, KZN is a fascinating place when you look at coalitions, because people must remember that for the first 15 years post-1994, from 1994 to 2009, this was a province that was governed by a coalition, first led by the IFP, and then later led by the ANC. So this has sort of been the simmering coalition part of South African politics, sort of just getting the job done in a way, which is perhaps odd because of the sort of really bloody violent politics that have typified KZN's, century of political intrigue. But what makes this government of provincial unity, I think, different is that the ANC isn't the undisputed senior partner. It only got, 17% of the vote in a province where it previously had a majority. So it very much is a licking its wounds party, where the national ANC, is still the big player with 40% of the vote. So that is part of what changes the dynamics. Number two, of course, you've got an IFP premier, which is also useful. And you've got two DA members of the Executive Provincial Council getting along with their job. Now, to the extent that coalitions in South Africa are, no news is good news, the GPU in KZN has actually done quite decently in terms of making sure that there's a program of government. But there are a few elements that make its current position a bit more tenuous, a bit more on the brink-ish. Firstly, there's the fact that within other municipalities, friction between the ANC and the IFP have sort of soured the relationship considerably, with those parties talking in the direction of, look, if you're going to screw us at municipal level, we're going to sour at provincial level. But what makes the sort of guardrails a bit stronger of these three parties sticking together is, I think, the ANC, what remains of the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal, is that bit of the ANC that probably never would have crossed over to Zuma in the first place. It might be factions that were never in line with Zuma, or just pragmatists. But the point is, if you think MK is the ANC of old in the province, then what you've got as the ANC today is the rest of the of MK, as it were, that couldn't go with them. So the fact that there's still an ANC means that that ANC and MK and KZN are unlikely to find common ground, at least in a sort of unified, coherent form. Then you've got the IFP, who cannot work with MK, because MK is an existential threat to the IFP's claim on the Zulu nationalist vote. So if the IFP throws its lot in with MK, then that's the end of the IFP, effectively. And the DA has made it very, very clear that on ideological grounds, on grounds of corruption, so on, they can't work with MK. So these three parties have a relatively strong case for not working with MK. And that, of course, holds the balance of the provincial legislature 40 against a potential 40. Because the KZN legislature, 80 seats, MK has 37, EFF has 2, NFP has 1. So if the NFP leaves, officially leaves the block of the GPU, then you've got a 50-50 split percentage-wise, with 40 seats in the government on the government benches and 40 seats on the opposition. Then the speaker essentially becomes involved in every vote to match that numerical balance. But the problem is that the NFP, despite only having one seat, what we hear from the ground in KZN is that the NFP itself is torn in two, that the NFP as a party has two different directions of travel. Does it stick with the GPU or does it go over to MK? So it is impressive that a one-seat party can have internal ructions, but these internal ructions are not necessarily in the seat held, but behind the scenes. That's why we haven't had an official swing from the NFP as a party from the GPU to the MK so-called Progressive Caucus block. Otherwise,
yeah. I just want to make clear that there is one other player in this, which is the EFF, which holds two seats, which is how MK's 37 plus the EFF's 2 plus the National Freedom Party's 1 equals.
Yes. So the problem with this 40-40 split, this perfect 40-40 split, is that it could lead to an unprecedented level of provincial governance breakdown, at least in the legislative side of things. Because if you have a 40-40 split, you can't get a majority for anything. You can't even get a majority for a motion of no confidence. So if there's 40 on the one side and 40 on the other side, you can't displace the premier. What happens then is at some point it becomes an issue of COGTA, of the Department for Cooperative Government and Governance and Traditional Affairs, held by the minister, Velinkosini Tlavisa, the leader of the IFP. So it really is a bit of a ticking time bomb. It isn't a good sign when people say there is no crisis. No crisis in KZN unity government, says IFP. That's probably the surest way of knowing that there is a crisis. But the shape of the crisis is quite questionable in the sense that the NFP is still to decide which way it swings. And the real worry from the IFP and the DA side is whether there will be chinks in that ANC armor, whether one or two or three of them can be coaxed over to, in a motion of no confidence, vote with MK. Because if that happens, then MK is in. And then you've got the reverse of the paralysis of an MK premier not being able to be disposed. So we might be looking at the first credible circumstances for a rerun of a provincial election for a provincial legislature. It depends on what happens with the ANC and what happens with the NFP. The IFP and the DA, I think, are fairly solid in wanting the GPU to continue. It's the other parties, the ANC and the NFP, that would be where the crumbling comes from.
Yeah, and you can imagine how this happens, right? So there's this, you know, our MPs and MPLs don't have a lot of discretion on how they vote because they're sort of, you know, they're appointed by the party and can be removed by the party. But you can easily see someone, let's say, being offered a position in MK, in the ANC, if you switch your vote. switches their vote, immediately is fired from the ANC, but it doesn't matter. They go on to join MK. And yeah, no, that's a very precarious position to be in. You know, the next council sitting with this, I think, or sorry, next legislature sitting with this is discussed, I think, is going to be very dramatic. What does it actually mean, though, if MK gets control of the provincial government in KZN? I mean, you say that yes, there might be this sort of deadlock in the legislature, which you know, I think is obviously true. But you know, will MK have some extraordinary power and momentum that will come from this? Or what's your take on that?
Momentum, I think, is a tough thing because I think they're probably at the peak of their power in KZN, and I'd be very surprised if they can go above the 45% that they essentially have secured in the province. What I do think would be the consequence is taking the Zuma strategy of trying to inflict as much harm as possible on Ramaphosa's ANC. I would not be at all surprised if the KZN provincial government then becomes a vehicle for attacks on the ANC, using the levers of provincial power to really try and drive wedges in the ANC nationally. Because if you understand someone's desired endgame, you can almost understand everything in between. And if we take Zuma at his word, which I think we should in this specific case, that he wants to recapture the ANC, that he wants MK to be the vehicle for ANC rejuvenation in his image, and that he genuinely hates the Ramaphosa ANC, you can quite clearly see what Zuma would do with any inkling of power that falls to his party. So I think you'll see patronage to an extent that the GPU might have tried to eradicate it with Francois Rogers in the finance portfolio. I think you will see an escalation of likely political violence, political intimidation. But at a macro scale, in terms of the political currents in the country, I don't think it'll translate into massive momentum for NK, but I do think they'll use it as a tool with which to bludgeon Ramaphosa's ANC and perhaps try and rig not rig in the technical sense, but sort of balance of forces in favor of a Mashatile presidency within the ANC, so that there's the possibility of an ANC-MK team-up to reestablish the Zuma ANC post 2029.
I think the other thing it could do, though, is kind of increasingly delegitimize MK, because as you say, when they're in power, there's going to be a lot of temptations to start disagreeing about who gets what in the sort of spoils from that victory. And, you know, if KZN suddenly gets flung into some huge governance crisis, you know, one of the things that the kind of insurgent new parties often have on their side is they say, well, you know, we haven't been tried. You've tried all the rest. You've got to try us. Being in power will probably hurt that message quite strongly, I think. So that's, I think, another interesting dynamic to all this. Anyway, let's move on to our next one. And Herman, you know, we actually have talked about this topic last week when we made fun of the original proposal by Action SA. However, Business Day has written an editorial. I'm not going to say quite endorsing Action SA's proposal, but sort of considering it seriously. And let me just read from their editorial. Opaque last-minute polls are narrative weapons. In the final stretch before an election, a well-timed, poorly sourced poll can shift turnout, trigger tactical voting, and drown out real issues. Local government elections are supposed to be about service delivery, potholes, water pressures, and ward accountability. But when the headlines are hijacked by anonymous data, the public conversation veers off course. Now Action SA has tabled a bill to fix that. The proposal seeks to define and regulate political opinion polls, requiring pollsters above a clear threshold to register, disclose core methodology and sponsors, and submit to an oversight mechanism. It also proposes a pre-election publication blackout for 7 days and creates offenses with fines and criminal penalties for non-compliance, while delegating enforcement powers to a body connected to the Electoral Commission of South Africa. It's a commendable proposal, sure, but it's not without risks. And then the thing goes on to talk about the issue, and they sort of finish with this. So what's the fix? Start with disclosure. Every poll should carry metadata: who commissioned it, how it was conducted, sample size, margin of error, and link to the full methodology. That alone would raise the bar for credibility and give editors tool to vet what they publish. Next, apply registration and oversight only to large-scale polls, those above a clear sample size or budget threshold that protects small researchers and civics groups from being buried in red tape. If a blackout is necessary, make it short, 48 to 72 hours, narrowly defined and paired with sanctions targeted at anonymous leaks, not legitimate research. We don't need censorship, we need clarity. We don't need to silence the polls, we need to make them legible, accountable, and trustworthy. If MPs get this right, they will restore integrity to the campaign trail and give voters the space to focus on what really matters. If not, the noise will only get cheaper and nastier. You know, like, Herman, on one hand, there's something to be said for the on the one hand, on the other hand approach.
Hmm.
This doesn't seem like a good case of that. You know, it's like saying, on one hand, we should spend our money wisely. And on the other hand, we should blow it all on blackjack and cocaine. These are not even close to each other, equal propositions. And I don't really see how you can say, oh, well, you know, we can find some sort of balance between political, you know, political censorship and method polling methodology. Your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think it did. What bugged me about this whole editorial nonsense is how dishonest it is. It sort of pretends that a deluge of inaccurate or sinister polling has consistently been a factor in South African elections and have had a marked impact. I mean, they even go as far as to say, this is not a theoretical problem. And yet they offer no example of a last-minute poll. They offer no example of a poll that was even questionably published in the last days of a campaign. I can think of one published on the 26th of October 2021 by Action SA, when they said in Tswane they were on 25% of the vote a week before election day, only to plummet below 10% on election day in Tswane. So the problem with this entire idea of restoring integrity to the campaign trail is the assumption that polls have had any role in the integrity of the campaign trail before now. The first time in South African history in 2024, we had a tracking poll taking us on a relatively day-by-day basis over the final weeks of the campaign trail. That poll, that tracking poll from the Social Research Foundation, was actually bloody accurate in the end. So it can't be that poll. What other poll are they referring to? And the dishonesty of saying this is not a theoretical problem. Yes, it is a theoretical problem, because you are making a statement of theory that this is a problem, that cheap polls are stealing elections, that there is at all enough of a problem here for the heavy-handed involvement of the state. And in an opinion piece for Rapport over the weekend, I sort of made the point that far from being a threat to democracy or the integrity of the campaign trail or the ballot box, independent private opinion polls quite serve the opposite. If we take the case study of the Venezuelan presidential elections in 2024, it was thanks to independent polling, independent data tallying, data and the flow of information outside of the control of the state, that it was at all possible to determine the scale and extent of election rigging that saw Maduro win another term and the opposition quite clearly having the receipts to prove it. So far from independent data being a threat to democracy, it is a support, a buttress of democracy. And President Ramaphosa, according to Mandy Wiener's book, The Deal, expected the ANC to get 54% of the vote. It isn't difficult to understand how a panicked political party with the tools and resources of the state would quite simply abuse its power to prevent any negative data, any data indicating a political threat to the powers that be, appearing in the public domain at any point in time. So I don't only think that this is ridiculous for Action SA to take this personal vendetta of Michael Beaumont to the point of actually drafting a badly worded bill on it. And I say badly worded because at one point they talk about the legislative draft talks about opinion tolls and exit tolls, not polls, which just shows that the AI that generated this piece of draft legislation quite lost the plot. But the idea that there's a problem to solve, there's no there. The poll-shaped perceptions drove coverage and forced parties to respond to a number no one could verify. That moment exposed a weakness in our electoral system, the editorial says. Prove it first. I mean, prove that freedom is a threat to democracy before you give the state the power to tread on that freedom.
There was really good response to this by polling company leader Gareth von Onslin, our former colleague, just kind of taking this apart. And the one thing that's sort of brought up in these discussions, I think it's mentioned in the Action SA bill, is this publishing in a report a while ago of a poll or a number and then not saying who it was from. And then that ended up in the it wasn't that the poll was fake. It was that report just didn't include the details of it. And you know, like when it comes to this sort of stuff, when it comes to polling, it's often quite easy to tell the credible polls from the uncredible ones, right? It's the same as anything. Any claim that's made in the media, in the public space, is this a credible one or not? And you don't do that by saying, well, by my reckoning, you know, this is a too low number for the ANC. You just say, is this a company anyone's heard of? Is this a methodology that makes any sense? Is there some sort of track record of this group, having good performance? And it's the same as when someone reports that, you know, there's a scandal in politics. If it's some tabloid thing that you've never, ever heard of before, that's like a fake news site that popped up 20 minutes ago with a suspiciously AI-looking video as evidence, you'd be like, okay, well, that doesn't, you know, that's not credible. But if it's like an old established national newspaper or an independent journalist with a long track record of publishing things that are true or something like that, then obviously it's believable. It's like, you know, are they going to say, well, you know, lying before an election is now, it has to go through the Electoral Commission to be determined. It's like, well, good luck with that, because every politician's going to be in the dock for that. It's just silly. And, you know, we shouldn't even be, I think, having this conversation. Like, once again, as we said in our previous discussion on this, it's this idea that you know, you publish something in the newspaper and suddenly the entire country is just completely talking about it. It's all they can think of. It's like shifting public opinion. Most people have no idea what opinion polling says about the country, which is a bad thing. I think more people should know what credible polls are saying. And we make our efforts to spread that news. But it's true. Most South Africans have no idea. These things are not nearly as important as people think they are.
On your point of people genuinely have a good nose for when a poll is reliable or not, because they do that for everything else. They do that for sales, for, you know, Black Friday deals, for manifestos. The human mind is designed and adapted for figuring out BS from the truth. If we are going to say that, okay, cool, wait, on this particular question of elections, we don't trust the public to do this, then why have elections at all? Because if you're going to say that polls can't be published, and if people can't make up their own minds, then why have elections at all? Because then clearly the people are idiots and shouldn't be allowed to make these judgments in the first place. And I've just finished yesterday the third polling report for the IRR for this year. Our first one was on political party support, our second one on voter priorities, and our third one now on race relations. And a quarter of my entire report is spent on methodological questions, making sure that people understand what were the questions we asked, when did we take this poll, how large was our sample, why that matters, what the sample broke down as in terms of language, right, age, employment status. A quarter
establishing
of the entire
credibility
report is just on that establishing credibility. I'm happy for my report and for the IRR's polling to go toe-to-toe with anyone. claiming it isn't accurate, or that a different poll without that credibility and that methodological transparency is more accurate. I'm happy to have that debate because I know I've done the work. And if people can understand that, a special sounds too good to be true, then they can apply the same logic. If a poll doesn't give you its working, don't trust it. Just like if an internet or a Google ad doesn't show you the stuff you're expecting it to show, you're not going to click on it. The idea that Business Day's editorial has any right to pretend that the dynamic imagination of Michael Beaumont is sufficient for a limitation of freedom based on literally about a fart of reason, then I just think Business Day really haven't covered themselves in any glory.
Yeah, no, just silly, 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 all of this. And besides, every single time we ever talk about polling on this show or our colleagues on the Daily Friend, when they write something about polling and people don't like the result, they always just say, oh, why are you using polls? They're all just fake, or this is fake news or whatever like that. So, I mean, you know, I love the idea that everyone just sees, oh, poll says that MK is going to win the election. That must mean MK is going to win the election. I will now go and vote for MK, even though I wouldn't have before. It's like, okay. You have an interesting idea of how people work. But anyway, let's go on to our last story. Now, we did talk about this on Friday. This is a proposal Go ahead.
Can I actually say a last thing on the previous topic, just before I forget? Gareth Monson makes a very, very good point about the reporting on polling. And that to the extent that Business Day moans about reporting on polling, they are the people reporting on the polling. If you don't have the journalistic and reporting capacity to accurately interpret polling, then what business do you have at all publishing this stuff in the first place? So the media themselves, irresponsible with reporting polling, we've seen it and we've experienced it, are now moaning that the polls are the problem rather than their rather vapid understanding of it. Now, I've spoken to journalists who understand polling very well, and I've spoken to journalists who understand nothing about polling. And it is for them to decide, for the editors to decide, am I going to stake the reputation of my publication on a good reporter with an insight into polling? Good. Am I going to stake it on a reporter with no idea of how polling works, who can't explain why this poll is good or bad? Well, then that's your own idiocy. So frankly, that little flavor of, oh, but the media must be helped to report polls better. Yes, be better at reporting polls.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. All right. So on Friday, we talked a little bit about this proposal made by the Department of Health in Parliament that starting as early as next year, people were going to start losing tax credits for people who are paying for private health insurance. The health department insisted that, no, don't worry, we're only going to start with the rich. I think they said over people earning over 750,000 rand per year, and you know, we'll slowly sort of work down to everyone else. There was a piece in Currency News which was quite good on this, pointing out, however, this ridiculous contradiction in what's going on and what the department has been saying. While going before Parliament and talking about the national health insurance and the plan to fund it, you know, by taking away these tax credits and various other things, it's all steam ahead, maybe even next year. But then when going to court and fighting over NHI, the health department is saying, well, you know, actually, we have no current plans to raise additional levies or cut tax credits. So which one is it? Alex van den Heuvel, who's an adjunct professor at Wits University and is one of the best voices on this, says there's political puffery in this. The ANC has to keep saying it because it can't back down politically, but the fiscal framework required for NHI is laughably unrealistic. Herman, you know, it does seem here like Nicholas Crisp and the Department of Health are kind of on their own, you know, mission here, this sort of, you know, almost like rogue cop mission here to implement NHI regardless of reality or what Parliament says or what the courts say. I don't know. That's just the impression I get from this desire to say one thing in court and another thing in Parliament.
It is the dishonesty that goes to the heart of the entire NHI project, driven by Nicholas Crisp, who is a particularly untrustworthy individual, who blatantly lies about the NHI, about its affordability, about its budgetary requirements. And what is awkward here is that in terms of South African law, it is a criminal offence to mislead Parliament, and it is a criminal offence to mislead a court. In terms of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislators Act of 2004, a person found guilty under the Act is liable to a fine or to imprisonment of a period not exceeding 2 years or both. In terms of lying to a court, you can get up to 10 years in prison. So someone has to choose, though, they're at the health department. Did they lie to Parliament or did they lie to the court? Because hopefully they lied to Parliament, because then the sentence might be a bit shorter. But the reality is that it is so beautiful. And kudos to Currency for catching them in this blatant lie. We are looking at a government program that will make it more difficult for people to afford healthcare that actually works. That will be the golden pot at the end of the corruption rainbow. That no one can tell us how much it will cost. That no one can tell us how they will pay for.
Well, but no one in government. Private estimates put the thing at like
over $1 trillion. Even private estimates put it at the lower end of $200 billion a year and at the higher end at $700 billion a year. So you've got uncertainty and dishonesty and risk and state control, the same state that gave us the beauty of load shedding. And now they're just caught in a lie. Because why? It's the only way to get this particular project to move forward. The GNU might not have many formidable successes, but shout out to National Treasury, to Godongwana, Masondo, and Sarapen for understanding at least more than Aaron Motsoaledi that, and Nicholas Crisp, that things paid for by the government have to be paid for. And this idea is beautifully dishonest and incredibly dangerous. And what would be the consequence of, as you pointed out in our pre-show chat, of ending tax credits now, only for the NHI to kick in a few billion rand and a few years down the line, is such a fundamental piece of shystery that you almost have to applaud Nicholas Crisp for having the guts to not only think of this, but to say it out loud.
Yeah, no, it's just the first of many attempts at raising taxes. I think if there's one thing we've learned from the new balance of forces since the last election, is that raising taxes across the board as aggressively as was done before is no longer an option. You know, if it was, we would have gotten the 2% VAT increase or whatever it was that the ANC originally proposed back in the budget. So, I think that the chances of this flying are actually kind of low, but we'll see. You know, this battle is not even close to finished, and it's going to be fought in courts, it's going to be fought in Parliament, and it's going to be fought on the airwaves for many, many years to come. Which, you know, yet another example of why NHI is just such a huge waste of time. Like, it's clearly not, like, even if you thought that this was an amazing idea, just practically and politically speaking, you need to scale it back a bit and think about, okay, well, you know, this is not going to work. We're going to be stuck in this, at the optimistic estimates of government, for 10 to 15 years of trying to implement this new system. I mean, it's just kind of insane.
And if you look at scaled back pilot projects of the NHI over the last 10 years,
it didn't work.
Failures upon failures upon failures, medicine running out, equipment not being available. So every single indicator of sound reason points to this thing being a disaster. And yet we've got people like Nicholas Crisp just married to this idea of a nationalization, state takeover, corruption, par excellence, pot. And I mean, what a beautiful, you know, shame.
and Herman will make fun of us for being free market ideologues. I don't think we've ever done anything as doggedly oblivious to the universe as this. Anyway.
Incredible. Almost admirable. I'm not even mad.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Okay. With that, let's call it to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found this show interesting. We did record a little bit earlier than usual. So if, I don't know, the union buildings catch fire or Ramaphosa turns into, splits into two Ramaphosas on national TV or something, and we miss it, we'll talk about it tomorrow. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, and have a wonderful day. Cheers. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.